So with that, I think we're ready to kick off today's session. Our speaker today is Steve Dymock from the Technology and Innovation Field Services Division here at EPA. Before I turn it over to Steve, I remind the phone participants again to put your phones on mute, and you can do that by hitting star 6 at any point. Again, put us on mute, do not put us on hold. An introduction, Steve has been a chemist with more than 15 years of experience, including 4 years in a commercial analytical lab and 8 years in environmental consulting. He joined us here at EPA in 2005 with a focus towards enhancing acceptance and use of emerging analytical technologies and sampling strategies. His perspective draws on years of practical laboratory and field experiences to help apply EPA's TRIAD approach at Superfund, Brownfields, RCRA, US, and state cleanup sites. Steve's efforts have actually resulted in development of numerous case studies, profiles, and training courses that have helped outline these successful strategies for the use and understanding of collaborative data sets, adaptive QC programs, and real-time analytics. We'll also be joined on the phone by Bob Johnson from Argonne National Lab, who will be one of the instructors for upcoming seminars in this 8-part series. So with that, I'll turn everything over to Steve.
Okay. Thanks, Jean. I'll go ahead and solicit any questions from the previous session that we did last Thursday on demonstration of methods applicability. We'll just take a minute to see if we have any remaining questions regarding some of the concepts that I introduced last Thursday. Again, I realize I went a little bit long in terms of timing for the slide, so we'll just take 1 minute to see if anybody has questions regarding that stuff, and if not, we'll jump right into today's session on XRF and appropriate quality control.
We don't have any remaining questions coming in online, although we will wait a moment or two. Again, if you want to submit questions online, simply click the question mark icon. You can type them up. Those of you who are on the phone lines, feel free to hit pound 6 to unmute your phone lines and go ahead and speak up and ask Steve any questions you might have.
Hopefully, months from now or years from now, many of you participants will look back on August 2008 with fond memories. Some of you will probably, when the date of August 2008 comes to mind, you'll think of Michael Phelps and his unprecedented 8 gold medals.
That's right.
And the glory of the Beijing Olympics. Yet others, like myself, and hopefully a few of you online, will hearken back to the days of XRF Month.
That's right.
On Clue In Studio. So right. we thank you all for being with us, and I'll jump right into today's session on quality control.
So we're starting on slide number 4.
Can we go back to the intro one real quick? We're starting on slide number 1, just the intro. Just a couple of comments. We've received a number of comments and questions during this seminar series that have related to the acceptance of XRF data for risk assessment and collection of definitive versus screening data. Just my thoughts on that. I think there's still a fair amount of work to be done to educate practitioners and data users, but obviously a good quality control program is critical for XRF data moving beyond the screening designation to more definitive uses such as delineation, confirmation, and risk assessment. And hopefully many of you attended last Thursday's session on DMAs and you were introduced to the advantages and the value that conducting even a limited demonstration of methods applicability, what that can bring to your project. And so the second half of Thursday's session focused on translating the DMA results, that is taking the information you learned from your DMA and translating it into things like the optimization of standard operating procedures, sampling design, quality control, dynamic work strategies, and contingencies. The focus of today's session is on the types of quality control samples that are available to you, how they can be used, some examples of some of the tools and strategies that we've used successfully at sites, and also we'll look at some potential pitfalls that highlight the critical need for good quality control with regards to XRF. So now we can go ahead and jump ahead to slide 4.
Mm-hmm.
My slides are misnumbered, but I'll add 2, and I think I'll be all right. So if everyone's on slide 4 now, what can go wrong with an XRF? Well, in my mind, the picture on the right there represents what some people feel when it comes to quality control, that is to say, if we pretend it doesn't exist, then we shouldn't have an issue. And this gets back to that operating principle that's been employed with XRF in the past, which is to say we take a few good splits, get a good correlation coefficient or R-squared value so that we know the XRF is good. And then from there, people would operate in operate the instrument in unconcerned bliss. And but really, there's a whole host of issues that can arise from using XRF at your site. And so here's a list of some of the things that we're going to talk about today, and some of the things that we're going to watch for. And to spot these issues before they have a significant impact on your project, you really need a quality control program. Now, of course, Dina covered many of the issues that we need to be aware of regarding sampling and representativeness. And hopefully you are conducting a DMA so that you have some idea of where your greatest uncertainties lie with regards to use of XRF at your site. And then you can allocate your resources appropriately to manage those on this list that as your program progresses. Quickly, initial and continuing calibration problems, instrument drift, window contamination, interference effects, matrix effects. We talked a little bit about moisture and some of the interference effects with arsenic and lead. We'll get more into that today as well. Unacceptable detection limits. When do detection limits become inappropriate for use? XRF becomes inappropriate because of detection limit issues with regards to the decisions that you're trying to make. Heterogeneity effects. Dina touched on those, and that's probably one of the biggest. And so a lot of the strategies and QC strategies will deal with controlling variability within your sample and within small scale, i.e. a couple of feet within your decision unit. And then finally, operator errors are certainly something that can happen. We like good, you know, you really need good contact with the window of the instrument. So, you know, and Dina touched on the surface preparation. Even in an in-situ mode, a little bit of surface preparation can go a long way to ensuring that you have good contact and a good matrix to introduce to the XRF. So let's go ahead and move to slide three. I'm sorry, slide five.
Here you go, slide number five.
We probably beat you over the head sufficiently to show that often sample variability is the driver in terms of overall measurement uncertainty or variability, but I'm just going to show a couple of more slides with some examples of that. And so here we have a series of regressions. When I do these live, every once in a while, I'll ask folks, okay, which one? Two of them are XRF versus ICP and two different instruments that we were evaluating, and one is two different ICP labs. And so we often ask folks, which one do you think is the ICP versus ICP? And every once in a while, I get a savvy participant who guesses the one in the bottom right-hand corner because there's less samples. So let's go ahead and move to the next slide. But that is indeed the case.
Slide number six.
If we focus solely on the correlation coefficient, we would see that actually the poorest is the two ICP labs. These samples are from a real site that we were involved with, a real tech support site. The samples were archived on the order of 20 or 30 grams in a sandwich bag. They were analyzed for arsenic by ICP, by a couple different, by a regional lab, and also by folks with the emergency response team. And as you can see, the correlation coefficients were better for both the field portable XRF instruments in terms of their correlation with ICP as two different ICP methods were to themselves. So again, just a caution that if we focus solely on correlation coefficients, we miss some of the intricacies of the relationships, the collaborative relationships, and also just really shows that you can't expect your field instruments to correlate any better than two labs would do within the same sample support. Let's go ahead and move to slide seven. Another example of that. Here we have triplicate subsamples from the same sample. The sample was passed through a 10-mesh sieve and then analyzed by both ICP and XRF. And the results shown here: on the top you have arsenic, and on the bottom you have lead. And what's interesting, if you notice, we have the confidence intervals built around the triplicate samples. And in the case of the top sample, of the top result for arsenic, you see that sometimes ICP is more precise. So you look at the width of that band with ICP, you're on the order of 200 to 240 ppm is somewhere around what that confidence interval would be. Yet When you look at the XRF result, you have a slightly higher number and also a wider confidence interval. But unfortunately, we can't generalize, because the opposite is true from the same sample for lead. So you look at the graph on the bottom, you see that the confidence interval for ICP for lead is actually pretty wide, on the order of under 100 parts per million to somewhere in the vicinity of 175 ppm. Yet, if you look at the XRF value for lead in that sample, you see the confidence interval is actually very tight, with an average of around 174. So, again, sometimes ICP does well, and sometimes XRF does well in terms of precision. So let's go ahead now and move to slide number 8. Just to highlight this example, here is the situation reversed for another sample from the same yard. So you look at the example on the top now, and in this case, XRF is more precise for arsenic. And you look at the sample on the bottom, and in this case, ICP has better precision for lead. So if you compare slides 7 and 8, you'd see that in one case, XRF is more precise, and in another case, ICP is more precise for the same two elements. So, again, what else do you notice though, in the series of images? The XRF average is almost always greater than the ICP, and that's something to keep in mind. I think we've touched on it a little bit, but again, I think it's likely that interplay between the XRF total measurement versus the ICP digestion value. But I think in many cases the XRF number is conservative due to this very fact. So if we're using field-based action levels, which we'll talk a little bit more about, but I introduced the concept last week in the DMA session. So if you're using field-based action levels, in addition to these quote-unquote conservative XRF concentrations, we should have a pretty good high level of confidence with regards to that we are minimizing our decision errors. Now, it should be noted that we never know the true concentration or the true mean of a sample, but for most applications, we consider the established laboratory method, which in this case is ICP, to better represent the true value.
Steve, I'm just going to pop in here real quickly. I've had a few people mention that the slides are loading slowly for them. If that is the case, you can use the diskette icon. It's an orange icon all the way to the right, and you can actually download the PowerPoint or PDF files to follow along manually. You can also find those in your confirmation email. There's a link to download the slides, as well as from the seminar homepage near the bottom. So if the slides are loading very slowly for you in your web browser, feel free to download the slides and follow along manually.
You want to answer this one question, or we'll jump forward a few slides?
You can jump forward and go ahead to slide number.
Unfortunately, we're looking at the same speed in terms of the reloading of the slides, so I'll try to pause a little bit and give folks a chance to let the slides pull up. But if we can move to slide 9. Again, this is the last in the series of complaints, if you will, by me. This particular graphic illustrates the effects of particle size. So here we have a sample sent through a series of sieves passed through a 10 mesh sieve. We analyzed that portion that passed through. We also analyzed the portion on top, I should say, the portion that passed through the 10 but sat on top of the 60 mesh, and then the portion that passed through the 60 mesh, i.e. greater than a 60 mesh size. And what you see as you go down is a significant impact in both the size of the confidence interval, the range of the values, and also the concentration. So as you go from a 10 to a 10 to 60 to a 60, you start to see a little bit of an increase, although it's interesting actually, and you look at the 10 to 60, it's actually lower than the greater than 10 value, but nonetheless, you see the confidence interval shrink with particle size, and that gets to some of the things that Dina mentioned with regards to sample prep and some of these other issues, that we expect the higher concentrations to be in the smaller particle sizes. And they're also, although they have more surface area, they seem to perform a little bit better in terms of precision because they are a fairly uniform particle size. So if you look at the top, you're looking at an average of 548 for the smaller particle sizes, and you look at that sample on the bottom and you're looking at an average of about 392 ppm with very tight confidence intervals. So again, this is really just to illustrate that not only do we have issues when trying to make generalizations about XRF or ICP, but also trying to make generalizations about particle size. And so it just highlights the fact that we need to be aware of these things, think about them as part of the DMA, and ensure that they're not going to have a significant impact on our project.
But
if we can go ahead and move to slide 10.
Actually, I think we have a question coming in online.
Okay.
Hi, this is Dina.
Hi, Dina.
I just wanted to make the comment about why the 10 to 60 particle size concentrations are lower, and that's because they have had the less than 60 removed. So your less than 60 holds a lot of your concentration because it's a smaller particle size. So when you take that out of the entire bulk, the fraction that has the finest particle sizes removed will have a lower concentration.
Good point. Good point. So that's why you see that slight shift to the left with regards to the 10 to 60 range. So let's go ahead and move to slide 10. Okay, so sometimes in our live deliveries and after discussions of representativeness and some of the issues, showing some of the examples on that I've just showed on the previous slides, I gaze out across the faces and I see that look of desperation. You've shown us all these issues, but I am only one man, or I am only one woman. What can I possibly do to stem the tide of uncertainty? So let's look to slide 11 for our inspiration.
If you haven't done so already, just a gentle reminder to please place your phone on mute by pressing star 6.
Okay, a continuation of the slide entitled, What Can We Do? Slide 11. Well, first of all, we can recognize the advantages and limitations that both XRF and ICP or lab methods present to us. That is, both methods are not without advantages and limitations. So we can recognize those and rely on certain strengths of one method to strengthen our data sets and our decisions, what we refer to as this collaborative data. We need to recognize that uncertainty exists. I think we've hit on that quite a bit in this series of seminars, but we're mad as heck and we're not going to take it anymore. Jokingly, of course, but we recognize that the uncertainty exists. As I'll show you in a couple of slides, the National Institute of Standards and Technology recognizes it, so we should too. Unfortunately, or fortunately, we don't need to put a box over our head like the gentleman I showed in the early slide, because we have techniques to manage these uncertainties now and strengthen our environmental decisions. Ideally, we should perform a demonstration of methods applicability, or a DMA. We spent 2 hours on that last week, but I can't stress the importance of that enough. Even a simple DMA application can provide critical information that will really drive an effective and efficient use of field portable XRF at your site. Again, for those who weren't here for that session, quickly, a DMA is kind of an initial assessment of the technology and how it's going to perform at your site. It tends to have a sort of a front end quality control, i.e. we're going to be looking at a lot of QC issues on the front end of the program to try to basically structure our QC program from the things that we're seeing as a result of that DMA. Typically, they're built around site-specific sampled media. So in the case of XRF, you could potentially be using archive material because of the holding times for metals and the fact that they generally stick around fairly well. Or you can collect them explicitly for the study and also as part of the initial mobilization. So you don't necessarily need a separate mobilization. But they're useful for establishing the expected performance, identifying some ways to optimize our sampling and analysis program. Extremely useful for flushing out your potential analytical issues, sample prep issues, throughput, and other logistical problems to try to get your arms around where some of the bottlenecks might be in the process. And they're great for identifying the QC requirements that we're going to develop essentially as part of the DMA for full deployment. And that is, we're looking to identify our greatest uncertainties and then manage our resources to control those. But we also need to allow sufficient flexibility to adaptively manage QC issues as they arise. So it illustrates the need for qualified field and sample support teams that provide real-time data interpretation, troubleshooting, and feedback. Collaborative data sets. These are really what's going to give you the power of high-density real-time information from your XRF with targeted high precision and well-documented lab samples that allow those XRF skeptics a level of comfort. And also they can illustrate some of the challenges that arise from solely using lower density laboratory analyses to drive some of these programs as we've seen in the past. Go ahead and move to slide 12. I mentioned earlier the National Institute of Standards and Technology standard reference material, and we're going to talk more about these. These are an integral part of our QC program for XRF, but it's nice to see that NIST recognizes variability. So here on the right I have just a subset of the NIST 2709, that's a standard reference material, some certified values. And so these values are calculated as weighted means of results from two or more independent analytical methods. And these are some of the most homogeneous and well-characterized material out there. Yet, we still see, if you notice in the far right column, an uncertainty associated with it or an error associated with it. So NIST recognizes that this is to be expected with most environmental matrices. What's interesting, too, is if you go ahead and read the 2709, the 2710, and the 2711 standard reference materials, they describe the methods that were used to evaluate the material, how it was blended, how it was homogenized, how it was analyzed, all of those things. You see that actually XRF was one of the tools that was used to determine what some of these certified values were and assess the heterogeneity of the materials as part of the certification process. So if NIST recognizes the variability, we certainly should do that as part of our QC program.
Again, this is Jean Valent. Just a gentle reminder, please place your phone lines on mute. We can hear side conversations on somebody's phone line. You can mute your phone lines by pressing *6. Thank you.
If we go ahead now and move to slide 13, as painful as that may be. Hopefully it's loading fast for folks. But again, this is just another observation that I've had in reading through the National Institute of Standards and Technology reference material for these NIST standards. Again, I'm referring to the 2709, the 2710, and the 2711. Standard reference materials that we most often use as part of our QC program. And if you were to read the addendums in those, not only does NIST recognize the uncertainty associated with the certified values from these, but it also recognizes that there are digestion issues. There's a whole addendum in the back that talks about, you know, EPA has established a number of leach methods, if you will, for the determination of extractable elements. Methods like 3015, 3050, 3051, of course, most often used with those terms is the term total metals, which I think, as you can see from the leach recovery on the right, is a tad bit misleading. So NIST, in that regard, went ahead and asked a number of cooperating laboratories to analyze these materials using some of the leaching procedures and analyze the materials in, again, the standard reference materials for 2709, 2710. And they looked at methods like 3050, which uses the hydrochloric acid in its final step, or excuse me, 3050, using nitric, and they also looked at other methods that use hydrochloric. And they went ahead and did some replicates, and as you can see on the right, they have some leach recoveries that are just just reference values. So these are not certified values, but the fact that NIST does understand that there's a significant amount of potential for leaching inefficiencies with regards to what our standard methods are for analysis of metals. We see some classic examples in the final column on the right there. So chromium is a great example where we might go after it with XRF, and the ICP has traditionally poor recoveries. And the same can be, I mean, you can look at lead. Lead is, on the order of 69% leach recovery. So part of the expectation is that we would expect that XRF may, if we present the same exact sample to the XRF unit, read a slightly higher value than what we would expect from the laboratory just based on the digestion efficiencies. Now, this isn't the end of the world, but as we said throughout the course, this is an issue to be aware of, particularly when you're trying to assess the comparability of ICP and AA to XRF. And we'll take a look back at the DMA module and this concept, but I've been involved with a number of sites where the DMA and the XRF in particular actually illustrated some cases where the risk or regulatory drivers that we expected based on existing information that was collected through digestion and ICP type analysis ended up not being the major risk drivers that actually drove the delineation portion of some of those projects. And a classic example was antimony with some poor digestion efficiencies, but when we got out there with XRF, it ended up being a major driver in terms of the extent of the excavation for this particular project. So it's interesting that XRF can actually highlight some unexpected potential for some unexpected exceedances just based on comparison with the digestion efficiencies. So if we go ahead now and move to slide 14, we'll talk a little bit about, you know, what arrows do we have in our quiver. I think I've spent the first 10 slides or so complaining, so now let's give you some examples of what you can use to manage some of the issues that we've been talking about for all of these sessions. So what does our XRF QC arsenal consist of? And here's a list of the types of things that we generally try to employ as part of our XRF QC process. Things like the energy calibration and standardization check, that's something that the instrument essentially does when you turn it on. We'll talk a little bit more about that. I mentioned the NIST standard reference materials. We have blanks, which are generally made up of either a silica or clean sand matrix. And there's some advantages to rolling in blank analysis as part of your QC program. We also have well-characterized site samples. Bob Johnson gave us some examples of some really nice ones, but if you have a nice, well-characterized sample, you can actually turn it into part of your QC program as essentially what we call a site-specific check sample, which is really just almost a standard reference material of your site-specific matrix. So again, think of it as an SRM. It doesn't quite have the characterization and homogenization and some of the things that you would expect from the NIST standards, but you should have a pretty good understanding of the concentration of metals of concern in there and also the variability that you expect just by simply analyzing a series of, you'd send it off for ICP and also analyze a series of XRF values in the cup, and that sort of becomes your standard reference material. We also have classics like duplicates and replicates, and I'll talk a little bit more about those. A reference location for when you operate in the in-situ mode, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, but that's kind of nice as well. It's simply a place that you can keep control of to go back after rain events when you're operating in in-situ mode to actually go back and shoot in that exact location in-situ to determine if you're starting to see some effects from moisture. And then finally, you can incorporate matrix spikes, and you can also examine some of the emission spectra that comes out of the instrument. So these are generally the things that we're going to use to make sure that our instrument's operating in control, operating properly, and the like. Let's go ahead and move now to slide 15. I'll talk about the first one on the list. Standardization or energy calibration. Instrument startup seems simple enough, but most manufacturers and experienced users will tell you that you really need to have an instrument warm-up of 20 to 30 minutes prior to operating the instrument. And during that time, you can do this
standardization or energy calibration. But essentially, during this warm-up period, the X-ray generation and the detector components and the instrument temperature all stabilize, because actually significant temperature swings can sometimes impact instrument performance. So you like to get it up to a stable temperature and let all the components kind of stabilize. And I know in the case of some of the Intevex units, for example, the instrument will actually require a restandardization during operation of the instrument if the software detects some instrument drift. I don't have the exact value of what that drift is, but I do know that at a certain point the instrument will tell you you need to restandardize or re-perform the energy calibration. And the actual standardization or energy calibration really only takes a minute, and once that's done, then of course we usually run our series of blanks, standard reference materials, site-specific check samples, and the like to ensure that we're in control before continuing on with the sample analysis. But the purpose of this procedure, this energy calibration procedure, is really so that the X-ray peaks will be located in proper channels, that is, electron volt channels that are standardized by the instrument, and that correct intensities in terms of the number of counts will be recorded in each region of interest, and that the X-ray peaks that show up where we expect them in the spectrum. So it's a simple thing. The instrument does it on its own. You don't have to do anything other than when it asks you to re-perform the standardization or energy calibration to do that. In the case of the Intevex, it is a stainless steel plate that the instrument shoots off of. And in the case of some of the Nikons, it's the back of the shutter. And so it's a known material. And the instrument then calibrates itself in terms of the counts and the appropriate channels to look for certain elements. And then follow manufacturer recommendations, which typically can be several times a day. You may have to do this. But again, every time you turn on the instrument, it's going to require this, and some instruments will require it when the software picks up a drift.
And just one last reminder, if you're on the phone lines, please mute your phone line by pressing *6. Thank you.
Let's go ahead and jump to slide 16, and then maybe we'll answer a few questions.
Sounds good.
So initial calibration checks. Again, it's a little more labor intensive than some of the continuing calibration checks that I'll talk about in a bit, but we perform this as part of the instrument operation and field efforts. And the next couple of slides, I'll show you really why it's important to do this. But essentially, it's a calibration with standard reference materials, calibration check with standard reference materials, site-specific check samples. Typically, those are in cups. Typically, you don't have to be operating in the cup mode. You could be shooting bags or operating in the in situ mode. But the calibration checks are typically kept in cups. I have seen folks keep standard reference materials in bags, but you're on the order of about 50 grams when you get that stuff from NIST, and you really want to. It's not cheap, so you really want to take good care of it. So what are we trying to accomplish with the initial calibration check? Well, I usually complete a series of blanks as part of this evaluation, but for the standard reference materials and the site-specific check samples, the expectation is that through a series of repetitions, say 10 or more, that a quick spreadsheet check of the standard deviation of those repetitions for each element of concern should be around what the observed average error reported by the instrument for each measurement. So in other words, if you took 10 samples, and each 10 shots, each shot gives you a concentration and also an error. If you were to take the average of those 10 errors, you would expect that the standard deviation that you get from that should be on the order of each individual result that the instrument reports. So remember, it's important to keep in mind that the instrument reports one or two standard deviations as part of the counting statistics, but essentially that individual variability result should be matched rather nicely with the average of the 10 measurements. So an example of something that might cause concern would be if the average error reported by the instrument was significantly different from what the standard deviation was of the 10 repetitions that you took. So the average result of the repetition should closely match the known concentration. In the case of the NIST standard reference materials, the certified values, or in the case of site-specific check samples, what the expected value of the well-characterized sample is. And essentially what we're trying to do is make sure that the XRF performance in relation to the standard reference materials and the site-specific check samples is well understood initially. Even if one element's reading slightly high or low, we can use that information to watch for trends and other things. Again, the values don't have to match exactly. But for example, again, if the average error of the instrument is approaching twice the standard deviation of the 10 repetitions, that would, in my mind, be a flag that there may be some calibration issues. And again, in some slides coming up, I'll show you an example of why it's important to perform this this initial calibration check. So assuming that the results closely mirror each other and that the observed standard deviation is close to what would be expected, you can set some expectations for how you would expect variability to be in terms of your standard reference materials and site-specific check samples as you move forward. Now, in addition, hopefully you've been paying attention and performing that DMA that I continue to mention. But the observations from this initial calibration check should really mirror the results that you see in the DMA data set in terms of the 2 standard deviation and 3 standard deviation rules that we're actually going to use to create our control charts with here in a little bit. And essentially, hopefully you've worked through this in your DMA so you have an understanding of what this variability looks like. But in terms of site-specific check samples, you can also be thinking about, you know, what detection limit performance can I expect for the metals of concern at my site? What measurement times are required to get acceptable detection limits, i.e. how long am I going to be counting individual samples? And are there any elements present in the in background or in the samples that may compromise my system performance? Let's go ahead now. We'll take a break and answer a couple questions.
Sure. We had a question that came in earlier, and while we go through these 2 questions that were submitted online, you can feel free to use that question mark icon real quickly to type up another question now. If we don't have time for it now, we'll get back to it at the next break. Those of you on the phone lines will come to you in just 1 second. So the first question that came in earlier comes in from Tennessee, and I think this is in reference to an earlier session that we gave. And they ask how you homogenize a vegetative or soil sample.
Meaning it's mostly comprised of vegetation? I mean, we've actually done some replicate analyses on ferns to look at concentration of arsenic in ferns. But in general, if you're dealing with a soil matrix, we try to remove some of the vegetation from that such that we're shooting, even if we're operating in the in-situ mode and we're looking at a residential lawn, for example, we would try to peel back the upper layer of the root system and the grass and try to analyze that you know, inch or a couple of millimeters directly under that. In terms of homogenization, what we've done is really just scrape the top inch or so of material, try to get as uniform a particle size as we can with using like a plastic scoop or something of that nature. And it's really helped limit the errors that we see in the in-situ mode. So just a small amount of sample prep in terms of removing vegetation, large stones, and trying to get a somewhat uniform particle size to place the instrument window down on can go a long way in reducing the error that you would expect the instrument to report.
And there's a clarification, and the clarification to this question says, I was referring to the root zone vegetation for surface soil analysis. In some areas, you are removing 2 to 4 inches of soil. Does this represent a surface sample?
Well, I mean, obviously that's something that you need to talk to your decision makers about. But what, as I said, what we've done in the past is peel that vegetation back and then try to get the, you can even shake off the root system to try to get the dirt that's stuck to it, let that fall back to the area that you've peeled back, and in my mind, that's about as close as you're going to get to a surface soil sample as you can. But if you discuss these little intricacies with the folks that are reviewing these documents, I think it's fair to say that you can come to some compromise in terms of, you know, what a surface soil is and in this application, what a surface soil represents.
The next question coming in online comes from New Jersey, and it's in reference to slide number 12. would you consider an SRM, quote-unquote, non-certified result without an uncertainty value a suitable material to use for QC of XRF samples? And their clarification is that they recently submitted a CLAP for a project where we intended to use XRF for arsenic. The reviewers questioned the use of RM8704 to verify the low-end XRF sensitivity for arsenic. Our subcontractor proposed that this material because they couldn't obtain a certified value for arsenic at lower concentrations. Would you suggest any special treatment for the results from this RM? And then they ask if you're aware of any currently available SRM for arsenic below 100 milligrams per kilogram.
I thought the, and we'll include the NIST standards, but I thought, you know, my recollection of the NIST standards is that the value, the certified value for arsenic in the 2709, which is the low value, is well below 100 ppm. In fact, I want to say it's on the order of 20 or 30 ppm for the NIST standard for arsenic. Again, that's 2709. We'll include the references for the NIST materials. But yeah, my recollection is that is significantly below 100. In terms of the error issue, I might let Bob chime in on that, but if he's on the line.
I guess I could jump in, Steve. I think from an error perspective, you know, the utility of the error is it gives you a sense for how good the standard actually is. When you're using a calibration standard, you're really after two different things, as Steve has gotten at. One is whether the instrument has a bias in it at the start. Second is, as you're going over time, are you seeing some kind of drift in your instrument's response that you ought to be concerned about? In the latter case, it's not so important to understand what the error is associated with the concentration in the standard because it doesn't really matter for tracking system performance over time. Initially, it is a bit of an issue, and I'm not sure how best to handle that. You know, you can get prepared standards that are spiked. Oftentimes, those spike samples, though, don't come with a certification as to the error bars on the on the spiked amount, so that is a good question.
Well, in the 30 seconds that you allowed us to quickly look this up, I did. Gene pulled up the 2709, and the reference value for arsenic in 2709 is 17.7 plus or minus 0.8
micrograms.
That's a mass fraction, though, Gene. We got to. There should be a ppm value.
Scrolling through here trying to find an answer, I thought it was
fairly low ppm value. But again, we can look into that, but certainly I mean, we've used these standards in the past for arsenic sites, and I don't recall our arsenic numbers being that high. I thought we had milligrams per kilogram arsenic at 88 to 110. Yeah, that's not as good as I had recalled. So we can look into that. We can check with some of the NIST folks and some of the manufacturers to see if there are other standard reference materials out there. The Buffalo River sediment was one, which I think it was the one that you referred to. So maybe perhaps we could, for the sake of time, allow ourselves a little bit of time to go and research some other ones, talk to some other folks here, and see if we could suggest a more appropriate standard reference material.
For those of you who are on the phone lines, if you have a question, feel free to unmute your lines and vocally speak up. You can unmute by pressing pound 6.
Okay. And then finally, again, we want to make sure that the observed standard deviation for that we see in this calibration check should be similar to what we see in the DMA and what we're actually going to use as part of our control charting process that I'll discuss coming up. So let's go ahead and move to slide 17. And this is an example of why it's important to go ahead and do this initial calibration check. In a lot of applications, you may be renting a field portable XRF, maybe borrowing the unit, you may be receiving the unit from the manufacturer. So for those of you who have ever rented this type of equipment, you know that you should have few expectations that the previous operator handled the unit with kid gloves, or that those in charge of the maintenance have tuned the instrument back to perfection or to the point where it's running like new. So this example shows why it's important to go ahead and do the initial calibration check. But even if the unit that you're operating is yours and you treat it better than your dog or your ex-spouse or whatever the case may be, it's still a good idea to go ahead and perform this type of evaluation. Actually, it should be the previous slide. But the particular instrument shown here on the table had a standardless calibration done by the factory. The two primary elements of concern at the site were uranium and molybdenum. And as Bob mentioned several times, XRF is actually a very good instrument for chasing uranium. And in this case, they had a blank along with five spike standards. And there was also one well-characterized historical sample available. And they went ahead and performed the initial calibration check, and the initial calibration check was not good. As you can see, the detection limits for uranium appeared to be significantly higher than expected. So if you go ahead and look at the known column, the 50 ppm standard for uranium, they would expect to see somewhere in the order of 50 ppm. They got a non-detect. Similarly, the spike standards performed poorly, and really the one that was of the biggest concern is at the bottom row there, is the archive site sample where they know they had 100 ppm uranium, and yet the instrument was reporting on the order of 230 ppm. So there was a huge discrepancy between the archive sample result for uranium and what the XRF was reporting, and ultimately it turned out to be a bad instrument or a factory calibration issue that required replacement of the unit. When they got the new unit out there, these issues were resolved. So this is an example of if you don't do that and you just jump right into your program, you could be getting some results that are questionable, and you really need to compare those to your standard reference materials, your spikes, or your archive site samples, your site-specific check samples. So we go ahead and move to slide 18. Continuing calibration checks. I think I've shown you why it's important to go ahead and do that initial evaluation, so let's jump into how we're going to do continuing calibration checks. And in general, we like to say that you should do them at least twice a day, i.e. at the start of instrument operation and then at the end, but often a higher frequency is recommended, such as every 10 or 20 samples. And in this fashion, if an out-of-calibration situation is encountered, then all the data collected since the previous check are now in question. So folks may be aware of continuing calibration checks on a GC mass spec type operation. And the same can be said where if your continuing calibration standard is out, you have to rerun all the samples that were run since your previous continuing calibration check. So this is the same type of information that you would see. Instead of using all spike samples, in this case, we're going to be doing our continuing calibration checks with a series of blanks, standard reference materials, and some site-specific check samples. Of course, if you have spikes, you can go ahead and use those. But this balance, if you will, it's really a balancing act. I mentioned it before. Obviously, you don't want to spend 90% of your time running QC samples, but you also don't want to lose large amounts of data to QC problems. So you have to weigh the time that it takes to run your series of standard reference materials, site-specific check samples in a blank, versus losing or rerunning or qualifying data. In other words, how easy is it to reproduce the data or reanalyze the samples? If the samples are archived, maybe a lower frequency of checks may be okay. In other words, if you have bags lying around, maybe you can get away with on the order of every 20 or 50 or 100 samples, depending on the throughput that you have, because in the case of an out-of-control situation, the material's there, you can go back and reanalyze. But if you're collecting large quantities of in-situ shots, perhaps at a higher frequency, or perhaps you might want to use a higher frequency of QC there, because particularly if you're making remedial decisions or you're driving excavation or something along those lines with an in-situ program, if you find out at the end of the day that you had an out-of-control situation, then essentially that calls into question all the results that you were driving the program with during the course of that day. So again, we use a series of blanks, usually a quartz or sand, standard reference materials like the NIST 2709, which is the low value, the 2710, and the 2711, and also site-specific check samples if you have them. And ideally, we're trying to bracket the range of expected values. So I know, for example, lead in the 2709 is on the order of around 50, and on the high, which is the 2710, it's on the order of 5,000. And again, we'll provide you the NIST certified reference values there, but as you can see, there's really an order of magnitude between your high and low standard reference material. Now, if you have results that extend outside that, it's not the end of the world, but it's nice to also have your expected values, and particularly the decisions that you're trying to make within those bracketed standard reference materials. But you want to be thinking about things like, is the XRF usually higher or lower than the standard reference material? By what percentage or what ppm value? In the next several slides, I'll show you why this understanding is so important and how we can use it to spot problems with instrument performance over time. So let's go ahead and jump to slide 19. And I showed this as part of the DMA presentation last week. But here's an example of a spreadsheet that we developed as part of the XRF toolbox. I introduced that last week as well in the DMA portion. But essentially, this is just an electronic version of a control chart. And simple handwritten or plotted results can work just as well. Although, as you see here, the comment last week was rightfully so. The top value was 3 standard deviations and the low was 2. But here we have an electronic version of a similar control chart. And again, what you have here is results from your DMA or your initial calibration check that we're going to use to develop some summary statistics, and then we're going to plug those values into this spreadsheet, and that spreadsheet allows us to use a control charting mechanism as part of our checks on continuing calibration. So essentially how we would use a mechanism like this goes like this. We would use the DMA and or some initial calibration efforts, analyses to generate summary statistics. Again, we like 30 or more samples to go ahead and generate a control chart like this. And you would, let's take an example. If you were particularly interested in lead and arsenic at your site, you might generate 6 of these charts. 3 for arsenic using your 3 NIST standards and 3 for lead using your 3 NIST standards, or that may be a little bit excessive, in which case you can choose only 1 standard reference material, for example, your low value of 2709, that's in the range of interest, and maybe a site-specific check sample. Again, you have 30-plus results on these either standard reference materials or site-specific checks, and from there you can calculate a mean and a standard deviation. And essentially what you do each time you do your continuing calibration check is plug these numbers into this graph. You're watching for trends, and ultimately you're watching to see if you are outside of these regions of interest, the 2 standard deviation and 3 standard deviation rule. So you develop this chart, and then each time you have a continuing calibration check, you plug a value in, and we'll say we're using lead as an example. So I've gone ahead and done my DMA. I have 30-plus results of my particular standard reference material, 2709, and I go ahead and plug that value in. So you take your initial reading, and if the measurement exceeds 2 standard deviations, you would take it again. In other words, if you recall, using a 95 UCL, or 2 standard deviations, you would actually expect that 5 out of 100 readings would be outside of this value. So it's not unheard of to have a value outside of 2 standard deviations. So you take your initial reading. If your initial reading is either above the plus 2 standard deviations or below minus 2 standard deviations, you go ahead and evaluate that same sample with a second analysis. If the second reading is outside the 2 standard deviation window, then you would initiate corrective action. Things like change the battery, perhaps you would reinitialize the instrument, rerun your standard reference materials in QC to make sure you're back in control. Likewise, if any one reading is outside of the 3 standard deviation window, then corrective action would be immediate. So here's an example of how we use our continuing calibration checks and a control chart to ensure that our instrument is operating within control parameters that we've specified as a result of the information we've either gathered during the DMA or during the initial calibration checks, or a combination of both. Again, the value in doing this is that you can identify out-of-control situations as they happen, limit the number of samples that need to be rerun, and you can either do this at a minimum at the start and end of each day, for example, or you can increase the frequency. An example would be if you only did this at the beginning and end of each day and you went ahead and ran your check sample at the end of the day and you had one result for the analyte of interest, we'll say lead, and it was outside of three standard deviations, then all of your data for that day, you have no idea where the out-of-control situation started, and you would essentially be forced to go back and reanalyze all of those samples. So let's go ahead and move to slide 20. And I'll show you an example of what to watch out for in terms of these continuing calibration checks. And this shows basically what can happen. This happened to be a tube-based system, an X-ray tube-based system, with calibration checks performed at the start of the day and at the end of the day. And we plotted up all the results here. The initial measurement of the day was the first measurement along the X-axis, and with the measurement number increasing as the day went on, additional checks were made at various points. They had 150 ppm standard that was being used for the checks. And the reported error for 120-second measurement was approximately 9 ppm. That, in other words, when they ran the 150 ppm standard, the plus or minus 9 value was generally the error that the instrument reported and also was in line with the error that was expected with that particular standard. Now, the first indication that something was not right was when they started to watch the standard deviation associated with the data check as the data accumulated. And when they evaluated the standard deviation of multiple sets of QC checks, they found that the standard deviation hung around 18 parts per million, or twice what the instrument was reporting for individual errors. When they checked the average calibration result for start of the day readings versus end of the day readings, they found that the average concentration that the instrument was reading for this particular reference material was 153 ppm, or almost spot on what they would expect for 150 ppm standard. However, when they looked at the end of the day average readings, they were looking at an average of about 130 ppm, or about a 10% reduction or below what the calibration concentration was expected to be. So when they graphed the calibration checks as a result of measurement number, it becomes apparent what the problem is. And so as you can see, the results on the left, they had a pretty good spread in terms of what the concentration was from each calibration check. But if you look out there at 80 or 100 samples, you start to see the average concentration falling. So they had to ask themselves the question, why? And ultimately, what they found was that the battery was degrading with time, and that the obvious fix in this case was to switch the batteries after a set number of measurements. In this case, they started to switch the batteries somewhere on the order of about 60 measurements. So instead of going 120, 140 measurements every day, 100 or 120 measurements every day, they still did that same number of measurements. They just switched the batteries out about halfway through the day. And that loss of 10% that they were seeing in the end of the day check samples could be attributed to loss associated with the battery. And we'll talk a little bit more about this as part of your QC program, but keep in mind that with these field portable instruments, battery degradation over time can have an impact on the results that the instrument is reporting. So let's go ahead and move to slide 21. And let's talk now a little bit about interference effects. I think we've talked about this, we touched on this a little bit. I know Bob talked a little bit about it in some of the earlier modules. But essentially, what is an interference effect? It's when the spectra are too close for the detector to accurately resolve. And the result is a biased estimate for one or more quantified elements. And this just highlights the fact that it's another great reason to complete a DMA. In other words, are there metals present in the site matrix that would indicate the potential for these types of interferences. Do I have high lead in the presence of arsenic? Am I, you know, if I'm chasing arsenic, then I have to be concerned about lead. Now, the detector resolution is not sufficient to determine if a particular energy range is due to one element or another. In other words, the response happens to fall into that same thousands of electron volt range that the instrument can attribute to the response of one element or another. Remember, all these elements, they have multiple energy level responses depending on whether the electron was struck or the electron that was struck by the X-ray was ejected from either the inner K shell, the slightly higher L shell, or even the M shell. Although in general, with these types of field-portable instruments, the primary photons that are generated by the X-ray tube or the radioisotope source generally have enough power to eject electrons in those three innermost shells, and mostly in those first two shells, the K shell and the L shell. So as a higher energy outer electron moves down to fill those gaps, those are the characteristic X-rays that we see, and those, depending on where the electrons move down from, is also the reason why we see multiple responses in different spectral regions, i.e. alpha and beta lines. And we'll talk more about this again, but suffice to say that we have a K-alpha, a K-beta, an L-alpha, and an L-beta that are all responses for a particular element, and they're all in a particular spectral region of interest, and if any of these overlap with another element, we have the potential for interference effects. So follow the results of your DMA. Hopefully you will have identified these issues. Think about the manufacturer recommendations, what they recommend in terms of if you think these effects are happening. And then we use simple techniques like scatter plots, and I'll show you an example coming up where we try to identify conditions where we think interference effects are happening and they're of concern. And then we would collect collaborative data or potentially take alternative actions with regards to our XRF results so that we're selectively sending samples off for laboratory analysis when we think these interference effects are a potential issue. Let's go ahead and jump to the next two slides, and I won't spend a lot of time on these. Just quickly as some level of information, but here you have a bunch of different elements that you can get via XRF, the thousands of electron volts, that is the range where you would expect the response, and then the different shell energies, K-alpha, L-beta, and the like. And so here you see that you have a min and max range of in the order of thousands of electron volts. So that is, let's take, for example, arsenic there on the very bottom. You can expect a K-alpha response for arsenic in the 10.3 to 10.7 range. And likewise, lead is a potential interference because lead actually has a response in that range as well, and I'll show you an example of that coming up. So I included this table, and let's go ahead and jump to the next slide, slide 23. Both as just reference materials. What's nice is that a lot of the manufacturers also provide periodic table type references, and I'll show you an example of that too on the next slide, slide 24, that shows you all of the types of elements that you can get with XRF and what all of the different energy values are that you can expect in terms of a spectral response. I went ahead and I know it's small. It's not meant to be read as part of this presentation other than to say that all of the manufacturers generate these types of tables. They tell you the most appropriate sources that you can use to go after particular elements of interest. And as you can see here, different, whether it's a tube-based system or radioisotope or any number of things can get certain elements. What's of interest is really up in the top left value, and that is for each one of those instruments that you can get with an XRF, again, on the order of magnesium, up to uranium, essentially. Remember, those lighter elements that you see up to really potassium tend to require a helium purge or a light, a gas purge to get these lighter elements. But as you can see up in the top left-hand corner, the key component is what are the energies for the K-alpha and beta shells and the L-alpha and beta responses that you would expect from the instrument. And in knowing what those values are, you can look at other elements that you have at your site and determine if those have any sort of overlap for those sorts of things. So let's go ahead now and jump to slide 25. And I'll show you an example of what I mean. This is the classic lead arsenic example. Here we have a linear regression that was performed, and as you can see, it has all of the classic issues that Bob warned us about. Relatively low correlation coefficient of 0.48, not very good. We have correlated residuals, i.e. lots of points underneath the line. A slope that you want close to 1, and in this case is 0.86. And you have a couple unexplicable outliers up there in the top left. And those are what we're going to focus on. You know, if you were to go ahead and do this regression for arsenic and you saw that you had those two results there, the first thing I would want to know is what is the lead results in those two samples. So if we go ahead and move to slide 26. We can see, I guess the results didn't come through on this value, but I can tell you that the lead concentration for the upper point is 3,980 ppm, and the lead concentration for the lower point there is 3,790 ppm. So again, those two points up in the upper left-hand corner are what's driving the regression and the problems with the regression, and it's simply the spectral region where you would expect to see both the lead and arsenic responses overlap, and the instrument is having difficulty in determining whether or not that is lead or arsenic. So what happens is the results for arsenic in this case are inflated with the XRF because it's essentially attributing some of the lead response to the arsenic range, and that's why you have such a poor correlation. Let's go ahead and move to slide 27. And I'll show you one vendor's answer, and there are others. But this is a software algorithm that Innovex has associated with some of their instruments that automatically corrects the arsenic result when lead is present. So the instrument determines if lead is present in significant concentration, and then the algorithm predicts the contribution of lead in the 10.5 region, spectral region, based on the result from the lead beta response, which is in the spectral region at 12.6 keV. So it's essentially taking the clean signal at 12.6 keV of lead, determining what the lead concentration is based on that result, and then it translates that back to an area or response associated with the peak at 10.5, and can back out an arsenic number based on that lead beta signal. And as you can see, there's the algorithm on the top, but essentially the arsenic detection limit is a function of the lead concentration. And so as the arsenic detection limit, or the arsenic detection limit increases, as the square root of lead increases. So following this equation, let's take an example. If your lead concentration was 500, you take the square root of that lead, the square root is 22. Now, if your arsenic detection limit around 0 is 10, then you could expect that it would be the square root of the lead concentration plus 10. So in this case, with lead around 500 ppm, you could expect a detection limit on the order of 32 ppm for arsenic. And indeed, if you look at the graph of that relationship, it's not linear, but you notice if you look on the x-axis for lead, around 500 ppm, the points are right on the order of 30 to 32 ppm for what you can expect as a detection limit for arsenic. Now, many of you may remember the dismay that I expressed when during Dina's representative in this part when I described the data quality assessment process and all of the work that a chemist might go through to qualify a data point is estimated, yet when the result is used by most people, even when the qualifier is included, we typically don't include confidence limits or uncertainty or any sort of warning associated with that result. And I'll talk a little bit more about this in the next slide. But following that logic, for example, if your arsenic action level is 30 ppm and your lab result is 28 ppm, but it's estimated, most data users would still say we have a clean sample. In other words, we know there's uncertainty associated with that 28, but we haven't quantified it, so we don't know if it impacts our decision level of 30. And in many cases, people would just look at the two values and say our action level is 30, our concentration is 28, we're clean. But in the next slide, I'll present to you an opportunity to use an estimated qualifier to deal with this particularly troublesome issue of interference, and in particular arsenic and lead. So I'll show you a way that we think is a good way to use an estimated or J qualifier to illustrate the difficulties in reporting low arsenic values in the presence of lead. So let's go ahead and jump to the next slide, 28. Many of you, I mentioned Dennis Kalnicki in the first session. I gave him I wanted to just mention Dennis is a chemist with Lockheed Martin. He works for Jeff Catanzarita and others at EPA's environmental response team in Edison, New Jersey. And Dennis is really a wealth of XRF experiences, 25 years plus as a chemist, and 15 of those, or more than 15 of those, with typically with these types of units. And Dennis has actually helped us develop and present some of this course material in the past. But the premise of this slide, as you can see, is what do we do with the difficulty we have in resolving arsenic concentrations in the presence of elevated lead? Remember, XRF measures arsenic in the presence of lead, and there's a very serious overlap with the lead alpha line, L alpha line, by the arsenic K alpha line. And this has to be resolved by some type of overlap correction. And the accuracy of that correction is extremely dependent on the reproducibility of the energy calibration for the unit. So if you think back to the slide that I talked about with the standardization or energy calibration that I discussed earlier, that actually has an impact in terms of placing signal response in a certain channel. That has an impact in this particular element in terms of arsenic and lead overlap. So, you know, the accuracy of that correction is extremely dependent on the reproducibility of this energy calibration. So even a small error in the energy calibration can have a relatively large effect in terms of the accuracy of arsenic in the presence of lead. Now, it's entirely possible to calculate a statistical uncertainty for the arsenic concentration in this case, but it's almost impossible to factor in errors that may be due to a slight energy calibration shift, as I mentioned. So, Inovex, in fact, uses the statistical reporting limit for the arsenic even in the presence of very high lead. So, we had some, let's say, discussions regarding this. So in a lengthy conversation, we were discussing the issues of trying to chase arsenic in this particular site we had. We were chasing arsenic with lead. And Dennis indicated that he would often typically not report arsenic where the lead concentration in the same sample was 10 times greater than that value. And he felt very strongly that there was a significant uncertainty around those detection limits and those reported values. So in the case of non-detects, he felt it was unwise to assume that the statistical uncertainty represented by the detection level should be reported as the detection limit. So in this case, what he would do is essentially say, in the case of a non-detect for arsenic with lead, I would either, for a detection limit value, report the statistical reporting limit or one-tenth of the lead concentration, whichever is greater. Now, in the cases where both analytes were reported, if the lead level does not exceed the arsenic concentration by more than 10 times, we would assume that the arsenic data was reliable. So if you think back to Bob's discussion about determining the mean concentration for decision units and the fact that having the instrument report a number, even if it's below a calculated detection limit or reporting limit, that for statistical purposes is often better than having a non-detected value, that you could see we had a bit of a conundrum on our hands in that we recognized there was significant uncertainty for arsenic reported concentrations and non-detected concentrations below 1/10 of the lead value, but we still felt it was possible to report values greater than the statistical reporting limit but less than 1/10 of the lead for arsenic. So the ensuing battle was fierce. But in the end, we agreed that to label any value with an estimate as estimated when the XRF detected arsenic at less than 1/10 the concentration of lead, and thus the 10 times rule was born. So let's look at some examples. What do I mean? If you had lead detected at 350 ppm plus or minus, it's supposed to be plus or minus, 38 ppm, if we detected arsenic in the same sample, at 28 plus or minus 6 ppm, we would report that value as estimated. In other words, in this case, 1/10 of the 1/10 of the lead concentration is 35. The instrument still says it detects arsenic, but it's below 35. We want to report that value, but we're going to call it estimated because it is a reported value for arsenic below 1/10 of the lead. Now, in that same sample, if we got 350 for lead and 48 for arsenic, we would say it doesn't require a J because the arsenic value is greater than 1/10 of the lead, or in this case, 35 ppm. So this is kind of an opportunity to use an estimated qualifier for a particularly troublesome problem area where we have arsenic co-located with lead, and instruments are reporting arsenic even though lead is elevated and we realize that it has potential for significant, potentially significant impacts. The thing I'd like to emphasize about this slide is that it's an empirical rule of thumb. It's something that we use based on, you know, more than 15 years worth of experience with these type of field portable XRFs. We feel we're strong advocates for doing so. But as with any rule of thumb, you know, it may not apply in all cases and it may change as the technology improves. Obviously, if we get better detector resolution and better algorithms to deal with some of these overlaps, the instruments may overcome this. So you won't find this 10 times empirical rule or 1/10 of the lead empirical rule in any sort of published guidelines, for instance, like the functional guidelines that have a 10 times rule for reporting common lab contaminants and found in samples when they're also in the blank. You're not gonna see that in this case. But we do think it's a pretty good rule and it's particularly helpful when you're dealing with arsenic and lead sites. So again, the rule of thumb is, if you have a detected value below 1/10 of what lead is, the reported lead value in that sample, we would say that that value is estimated. We still say that it's detected, but we're a little bit uncomfortable with just using that particular value.
Just a reminder for those of you who are joining us via simulcast, you can submit questions electronically at any point in time by typing them up using that question mark icon. Phone participants are welcome to do that as well if you don't want to wait until the appropriate Q&A time. Steve, did you want to take a break for a few questions?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to start with the people on the phone lines. If you have a question, feel free to unmute your phone by pressing #6 at any time and verbally speak up. Okay, I don't hear any clicks, but if you come up with anything while we go through some online questions, feel free. Again, #6 to unmute, and you can go ahead and just speak up. But as far as the ones that have been submitted, there's a question that came in from Tennessee, and they ask, what is a typical acceptable SD for XRF field work?
I don't know that we can make a generalization of what the standard a typical standard deviation would be. It's very site-specific. It's very matrix-specific. It's very element-specific. Those are all things that we have talked about throughout the course of this series of seminars. So, you know, it highlights the importance of performing that demonstration of methods applicability, assessing, you can certainly assess instrument variability, and I'll show you an example of how we do it with things like duplicates and simply assessing instrument precision in terms of taking a shot, not moving the instrument, and shooting a series of shots in that manner. But I don't really have a rule of thumb for what would be an acceptable standard deviation. It's very, very specific on a whole host of factors.
And the next comment that came in online comes from Massachusetts, and it's really a comment instead of a question. And they state that your list of interferences is useful but incomplete. The periodic tables included in your presentation tend to only show the four largest peaks for each element. There are many other lines present. Also, as XRF units may use low-energy X-rays to excite the lighter or low Z elements, then you also have the possibility of M-line interferences. For example, lead M-line overlays F.
Yes, I tried to recognize the fact that there are shells beyond the K and L that can respond, and I'm glad to see finally that some of our vendors have jumped on, Debbie with Thermo. We recognize the fact. I mean, in general, the responses from some of those lines are fairly small, and we recognize that there are other shells that could present it, but you know, for the purposes of this discussion, in general, with these types of units, you can expect the biggest responses from the K and L's. But certainly, there are other interferences that are potentially a factor. And again, those go back to what is the resolution of the in terms of the resolution of the detector and some of the other things. I actually have a couple examples coming up of differences in detector resolution and whether or not it can identify a potential interference. But if we're going to get into the real nitty-gritty of some of these things, certainly we recognize that there are other shells and other potential interferences, but for a lot of applications typical of the type of stuff that we're doing here in environmental work with field-portable XRF, those are some of the big ones, but we do recognize that there are others, and I would encourage folks, if you do have, as part of your QC program, I have a couple slides coming up talking about looking at spectra and what that can do for you. If you have any indication that you may have some spectral interferences, I would encourage you to talk with your manufacturers, and they can give you some helpful hints as to how to deal with those and how to identify those.
And there's another comment that came in online from Massachusetts. If arsenic concentration is less than 10 times the lead concentration, could this value for arsenic be a false positive?
That's a good question. That gets into the specifics of what the detector calls a response in that spectral region. But in my example, the particular algorithm from the instrument that was used tries to calculate that arsenic value based on backing out the lead from a different spectral region, the lead from the L beta line as opposed to the other line that was mentioned in the slide. So, boy, that's a good question. I would think that it has the potential to be a false positive if there's a significant amount of lead in that region and the instrument is having trouble resolving it. One would think that a false positive is a possibility, which is why we recognize, which is why we like to J those values.
Steve, could I jump in?
Sure.
It probably depends on what your definition of a false positive is here. You know, arsenic is almost always present in background conditions, so an XRF detection of arsenic, if the detection limits are low enough, is not necessarily a false positive. Usually when we talk about false positives, it's with respect to some kind of action level. In other words, are we seeing an arsenic value reported above an action level that might indicate some action is required, and now we're concerned that maybe that's not correct because the actual concentration is less than it's just getting pulled up by the lead. And certainly in the case of arsenic, with its relatively low action levels, if you have a lot of lead present, you run the risk of having false positives appear on individual samples. So that's certainly a possibility.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Let's go ahead and move to, if we don't have any other questions or if anybody wants to quickly jump in with regards to the last series of questions, I'll wait a sec.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
We can hear you. Go ahead.
All right. Since in Brownsfield, and we're talking about arsenic and lead, and that's a big concern for us in Brownsfield, a lot of our sites are in urban. The background level of lead is really 200 on average, if not higher. And the lead that we're looking for on this remediation is around 5 or 10. Is the X-ray suitable Or are there things that I can correct using the X-ray to overcome this interference? Thank you.
I appreciate the question. I believe it was, okay, you have lead on the order of 200 ppm, and you're trying to chase arsenic at 5 ppm?
Yes.
Boy, you know, if you look at some of the newest instruments, even the detection limits reported for those are barely scraping at the 5 ppm level.
Right, we just bought an innovation, but I think that's at around 7, but that's going to be low. But even if it's at 10, we're concerned about using XRF data.
Yeah, I think you have a legitimate concern because the detection limits, even in the cleanest of matrices for those instruments, is on the order of, you know, 10 or slightly below. And in my experience, even with some of the newer units, we've felt a lot more confident making decisions concerning arsenic up in the 15, 20, 25, or 30 ppm levels. If you're going to be chasing arsenic at 5 ppm, I don't have a ton of experience doing that, particularly when you have lead at greater than 200. So I think you would have a legitimate concern in trying to make decisions about whether or not you're above or below 5 for arsenic when you have lead on the order of 200 ppm. And I don't know if anyone else on the line has additional experience, but my experience has been that's a little bit low
for some
of the newer units.
Here's what we've been doing, and, you know, I just like your feedback. What we look for is another element, like copper, a secondary element that would follow the arsenic. Does anybody else do that?
We've used surrogates in the past similarly, but not with those two elements in particular.
All right, thank you.
Bob, do you want to add anything?
No, just underscore the fact that XRF can be very effective for chasing surrogates. If you have something else that's co-located with the thing that you really want to chase, arsenic in this case, and you feel like the correlation is consistent, and there's something that prevents you from getting a good estimate on your arsenic, but in your case if it's copper, you feel like you're getting good data on your copper, there's no reason why you couldn't use your XRF for that. But the issue there, the primary issue there is what do you intend to do with the data? If you're just using the data to try to flag either problems versus non-problems, it makes a lot of sense. If you're trying to somehow back out average concentrations for arsenic, the question would be then, how do you do that using your copper data? And that's a technical problem. One other comment about chasing arsenic at low levels when you have a lot of lead. And I guess the question would be is do you find that your lead concentrations are relatively stable in that 100 ppm range? If they are, you know, the effects of lead on your arsenic are going to be fairly predictable. And so that's one of the things you could get at with demonstration of methods applicability study is to try to figure out how much of an impact that lead is having on your arsenic. It's going to have two different impacts. One is it's going to pull the arsenic detection limits up. The second is it's going to potentially bias your arsenic concentrations high. So long as you're still getting acceptable detection limits, it may be the case that if you do a DMA, you can kind of estimate what that bias is that's being introduced. You know, are you pumping up your arsenic by 30% or by 50%? And then try to correct for that as you're going forward. So it's not necessarily an insolvable problem, but it is going to be more difficult when you have lead at those concentrations.
Okay, we had one other question that was submitted online, and then I think we'll move forward with the slides. The last question online comes in from New Jersey, and they ask, in the example on slide 28, how would you interpret the assigning of a, quote, J value for a concentration of 40 plus or minus 8 ppm?
Again, we would just use it as a qualifier for estimation to at least alert the data user that there is some uncertainty associated with that value because it's arsenic in the presence of lead. I don't think we have time to get into interpreting J values for other reasons for metals results. I think that, you know, you can look at the functional guidelines or other things to make that determination. But already with a number like 40, you have an error associated with it. Depending on the instrument, it may be one or two standard deviations. And based on that, you may realize that your region of uncertainty is encompassed by, or your decision action level, if you will, is encompassed by that value, or it may be sufficient to make a clean or dirty determination. In other words, if your action level on this case is 100, and you're getting J values at 40 plus or minus 8 ppm, I'd feel pretty good about that number that I'm below 100. If the same situation was my action level was 40 or 45, I'd be a little bit more concerned about that 40 concentration and that J value. And to get around that, probably what I would do is probably take a series of more readings. Because remember, there's a whole host of other variabilities associated with this beyond just the analytical perspective. So if you add in your sampling uncertainty and your heterogeneity of your matrix and some of these other things, it's going to become increasingly difficult to get enough samples or enough shots, if you will, to make a determination when you have a number like 40 plus or minus 8 and you're trying to make a determination that at 40, 42 or 45. In my mind, that makes a great sample to send off for collaborative information because it's in that region where it's really too close to call.
Okay. Let's continue on. If you've muted your phone lines, please put them back on mute by pressing star 6. And we're moving on to slide 9.
Slide 29. Hopefully we can have a little bit more time at the end of today's session if I can get through all the slides in a reasonable time frame. The only thing I'll mention about monitoring detection limits is it should be part of your QC program. Remember, as Bob showed, detection limits for XRF are not fixed for any particular element or any particular measurement. And all of these things have effects, whether it's the measurement time, what the matrix is composed of, and certainly the presence of other elevated contaminants, be they located in the region of spectral interference or not. As Bob showed on day one, just with a simple example, how a relatively high concentration sample pulls up all of the non-detected values for all of the other potentially elements of interest. So just keep in mind that. And what's important is that we want to just keep an eye on those detection limits for situations where they become unacceptable and we need alternative analyses. So examples where our detection limits are jumping up over our action levels become unique opportunities to go ahead and send these off for some collaborative data. But you also have to keep in mind, too, if for instance, your arsenic detection limit jumps up over your action level, but you also have a lead action level of 400, and all of a sudden your lead's, 5 or 6,000 ppm, it's nice to know what the arsenic concentration is in that sample, but in the context of a decision, you still have an exceedance of lead, and you're probably going to do something about that sample. But it is nice to keep an eye on those detection limits. The other thing I'll note, too, is the error reading associated with individual results, that one or two standard deviation that's provided with individual results, can often indicate how some of these things are affecting your precision. So things like if I change my measurement time, what is that going to do if you see a better detection limit and a lower standard deviation? That may be sufficient to take care of it on site, or like I said, it's also an opportunity to send it off for collaborative information. Let's go ahead now and jump to slide 30. And just another quick example. Again, this table was shown earlier, and this is actually the one that I was referring to just a moment ago that Bob showed very early on, and these are some real analyses here. It happened to be done with an Innovex unit, happened to be 120-second acquisition time. But again, you can see what happens to the concentrations for your non-detected values as the result of an elevated soil sample, which is the far right-hand column. So all of those bold values are actually detected concentrations, but the non-bolded values are actually detection limits reported as ND. So you could see using the same instrument and the same operation profile, depending on the matrix, for example, your arsenic, you could see as low as 6 ppm or 7 ppm, or, well, in the case of the right one, you have a detected concentration of 29,000 ppm. But let's take antimony as an example. You could see as low as 60 or 55 ppm, yet in an elevated sample with high concentrations of other elements, your detection limit for arsenic jumps up to 232. The other interesting thing of note, again, is the lead value in that, on the order of 45% lead, probably exceeding the dynamic range or the linear range of the instrument. So would I believe that 45,000 ppm value? No, but again, in the context of a decision, this is a real nasty sample, and would make a really good one to send off for collaborative information should you want additional ICP type analysis of the sample. But with regards to a dirty or clean determination that you might be making in the field with XRF, that one, the sample in the far right column, is clearly very nasty, very dirty, and significantly impacted with a whole host of elements from arsenic to chromium to lead. So just keep in mind that those detection limits change over time, and they are impacted by a whole host of things, and so we can't have any expectations as to what that would be. So let's jump to slide 31. I think it's slide 31.
Yes, slide 31.
Okay. Monitoring dynamic range. You know, I mentioned, I kind of covered this on the last slide at the very end there, but again, this is part, another part that you can add to your QC program, but not necessarily a formal component as much as something to keep in mind. So what we like to do is just keep an eye on that dynamic range, and then periodically, in response to results that are exhibiting characteristics of concern, we may send samples off for either what we would call confirmatory analysis or collaborative analysis, depending on how we're using those. But essentially, we just want to make sure that, is there evidence that the linear calibration is not holding for the higher values? If you remember, for those of you who were here for the DMA discussion last week, I showed an example from the Fort Lewis example where the extremely high values on the order of 40, 50, 60,000 parts per million for lead, that we were getting with the XRF corresponded to lower values for ICP, but they still had a good linear regression, and they still were able to make all of the decisions that they needed to make at the site because all of their decision or action levels were at 1,000 or less. So even if they lose a little bit of linearity up above 25 or 30,000, you know, how significantly does that impact the decision? In that case, it was not significant. But it's certainly something to keep in mind, something we like to include as part of the QC program. So let's jump to slide 32. We recognize that matrix effects exist, but more than a Hollywood blockbuster, these matrix effects can significantly impact your project. So one of the ways we get at it is through multiple XRF measurements over a sample support surface. So if you're using a bag, for example, we would take multiple measurements. Bob's going to get into this a whole lot more. I'll cover a little bit more. I touched on it as part of the DMA, and I'll cover it in the next couple of slides. But there are some ways. Remember when Dina's discussion of heterogeneity, you were essentially given a couple different ways to get at this heterogeneity issue, and that is additional sample prep, i.e. grinding uniform particle size and the like, or another way to get at it is to take additional measurements across the sample support surface and then average those concentrations, if that's what you're looking for, is an average concentration within a sample support surface. But really what you're trying to figure out is what is the level of heterogeneity that's present and how many measurements might you need to determine that level of variability and determine a result that's sufficient to meet your decision requirements. I mentioned the reference point, again, for in-situ applications is something that we've toyed with to go back to a very specific location that's been marked, that's monitored and kind of kept as part of your QC program. It's kind of nice to go back and shoot that result to see how things like rain events or other weather-type influences can have on your instrument performance. It's sort of a non-formal way that we include a reference point as part of an in-situ application, recognizing that we know there's a degree of variability across an in-situ sample support, but if we evaluate that degree of variability as part of this, i.e., once we mark this little area for our in-situ reference report, or a reference point, we can take 10, 20, 30, 30 measurements at that location. We have a really good understanding of the concentrations that we can expect there for contaminants of concern and also what the variability is on that, so that we can return to that location as part of our QC program to evaluate it after things like rain events and some of the other things. So let's go ahead and jump to slide 33. And this comment was brought up as part of one of Dina's presentations on representativeness. It's something that we've thought about, particularly obviously with a bag type application. And we've looked at a variety of bags and we've found very little impact. But one of the ways that we've evaluated the impact is simply by shooting a series of analyses through the bag, including different areas of the bag, like clear areas and label areas, etc. Because you've likely, in this sort of application, already generated a demonstration of methods applicability and the data that comes along with it, the initial calibration check. So you should have a really good understanding of what the expected errors are and what the expected variability is associated with your QC samples, your standard reference materials, your site-specific check samples, and your blanks. You should have a really good understanding of what those values are looking like and what the variability is. So then we go ahead and then shoot a series of these QC samples through the bags. And if you see a potential impact to data quality from the bag, my recommendation would be do yourself a favor and get different bags. Obviously, thinner and clearer are better, but as I said, we've evaluated a variety of bags and found very little impact. The bigger issue is ensuring good contacts of the window with the sample. And Dina also mentioned, too, if you've got a bag that's really been roughed up when you were homogenizing a sample and it's got a lot of pock marks or we've even had some that have creases, and there are certain bag manufacturers that actually put ribs in the bag, some of those can have a potential impact. And the obvious explanation, for instance, is where we've noticed those types of impacts is the scattering of X-rays from a non-flat or damaged surface. And the result has generally been elevated detection limits and larger reported errors than you would expect. So again, you have all that information for your standard reference material, your site-specific check samples, and your blank. You should have a very good understanding of how those things are behaving in terms of variability and the expected concentrations. If you shoot those through a series of those through the bags and you find significantly different results, then do yourself a favor. You may have a potential impact from the bag. Go ahead and use some different bags as part of your sample collection, sample prep for that site. But again, we've found only a rare instance of where the bag had a potential impact. Let's jump to slide 34. I wanted to include a little discussion on the emission spectra issue. I think we got at this a little bit earlier, but obviously the spectral response that you see from these instruments is in the range of hundreds of electron volts. So, for example, the arsenic K-alpha response is in the range of 10.3 to 10.7 KeV or thousands of electron volts. So you're talking about 400 electron volts. So obviously the resolution of the detector has an impact in terms of whether or not you can resolve certain peaks that are either very close or overlapping. So here's the resolution of some of the latest detectors, and my quick look at some evaluation of some of the existing detectors that are out there on the order of about 190 electron volts. That's about the tightest resolution they can see. Older models were on the order of 280 to 300 electron volts, and this chart on the right really is just an example of what the difference in detector resolution does in terms of resolving peaks. So you see a lighter example and a darker example, and the darker example is an instrument with a 220 electron volt resolution versus the lighter example that has 140 electron volt resolution. And as you can see, with the 220, you can't resolve the differences between either aluminum and silicon or potassium and calcium in this example, yet with 140, you have two very distinct peaks in those spectral regions. So obviously, a higher resolution detector is going to allow you to deal with some of these potential interferences as we've discussed. But the way we like to use this as part of a QC program is to just keep in mind that the instruments do provide spectra. You can go in and pull those and take a look, and they may indicate to you some questionable results or areas of concern that you can then choose for collaborative information. Let's jump to slide 35. Bob's actually going to talk about controlling sample heterogeneity and estimating the number of measurements that you might need in a bag, and we have some other ways to do it. This happens to be an example for aggregate measurements, although as Bob mentioned that the when you're in the aggregate mode that the standard deviation reported or the error reported by the instrument is actually wrong. But here's an example of something you can do just by taking with a spreadsheet and a series of 10 or so measurements. And the goal here is we think we have a high degree of heterogeneity in the sample, and we're trying to reduce that heterogeneity to on the order of 30% or at most comparable to analytical methods around our action level, so on the order of 10 to 30%. And how do we get at it? Well, we take 10 measurements from a sample support, in this case a bag, to estimate the variability, and then the aggregate number is the standard deviation divided by the square root of n, where n is the number of samples contributing to the aggregate. So in other words, how many measurements are we going to take to reduce our aggregate error down to our goal of somewhere on the order of 10 to 30%? And typically it takes from 4 to 16 aggregated measurements, but remember, these aggregated measurements are generally shorter count times. I know the question came up last week about, well, you know, at what point do you say that's too many measurements and you need to do more sample prep? In general, I don't think we've done much more than about 10 measurements on a bag to try to control the heterogeneity, but somewhere on the order of 4 to 10 measurements is what you expect to be able to do that. So if we go ahead and move to slide 36, I made a fictitious example of the arsenic concentrations for two data sets just to show what the aggregate error would look like for these two data sets. So on the data set on the left, if you were to take 10 replicates of across a sample support, in this case a bag, and you had those series of measurements, your aggregate error would actually be relatively low, 9% on the order of what you would expect from a laboratory analysis. Now, if you were to take the same sample and you receive the data set on the right, you'd see that there's a much higher degree of variability, and to actually control that aggregate error of 40-some-odd percent, you would need to take more measurements in the bag. So again, this is something that I was just playing around with to try to figure out what degree of variability would produce an aggregate error of 10% that's reasonable and one that's unreasonable. And you can do this with a simple spreadsheet to try to estimate how many measurements you might need to control variability given your site matrix. Slide 37. I did want to talk a little bit about another how we assess instrument precision. Lord knows we beat up on the analytical laboratories for this, often at the expense of other potentially large areas of uncertainty and variability, as Dina has so efficiently displayed in her modules, but let's go ahead and hold XRF to that same standard for instrument precision. And how do we do it? Well, this happens to be another spreadsheet from the now infamous XRF toolbox that we've developed and that we're sort of beta testing now. But we created this as an alternative to using relative percent difference as the sole means to assess duplicate agreement. And so it works very similar to in what the control chart would do, and the procedure I'll quickly run through. We take the first shot of what is to be a duplicate set, and we record the reported concentration and the error. After taking the first reading, we do not move the instrument because we're trying to solely assess instrument precision. So we don't move the instrument from that spot. Then we enter that first reading in and along with the error into the spreadsheet. And we be sure to enter it in the correct column. In other words, some instruments produce a one standard deviation as an error, and others give two standard deviations, so it's important to know which one is which. And then the spreadsheet calculates a 95 upper and lower bound confidence. I'll note that the confidence interval is based on a Z distribution. not the T distribution, so the Z distribution is acceptable because it's based on the county statistics, which assumes a normal distribution, which is how we can go ahead and get a lower and upper confidence interval associated with a single result. And next, we take the next shot, and we don't move the XRF instrument yet. We enter the second reading in, and then we assess it. So we go ahead and enter that second reading in, and then we take corrective action accordingly. Let's examine three examples quickly just to illustrate the differences. If we can look at SW3, SW15, and SW26. And in the case of SW3 and SW15, the reporting value for the duplicate is within the 95 confidence interval, yet because the values are relatively low, they would exceed an RPD criteria of 20%. So this RPD 20% can be, or requirement can be problematic, particularly for low concentration samples, because even with the numerical differences, it's relatively minor. So in the case of sample 26, we see the opposite is true in that the duplicate is outside of the 95% confidence interval, yet the values are sufficiently high that an RPD value of 12.6% would indicate that you're in control, whereas if we were using the standard deviation results, we would say that we have a sample that is outside of our instrument precision requirements. So I'll leave it at that because we're running up against some time, but certainly duplicates and replicates are part of the QC process that we like to use. And if folks want to discuss this in more depth, feel free to contact me and we can go through it. And then finally, slide 38. Development of field-based action levels as part of your program? Absolutely, you bet. Has anybody ever tried to evaluate the comparability of non-detect pairs? It's extremely difficult. Or an example of one non-detect pair with a detect. The information is of very little value. So certainly, field-based action levels are part of our QC program. They help ensure the quality of XRF decisions, and they help us monitor predictive relationships, all of those sorts of things. And we're trying to maximize the values of these samples that we do take for off-site analysis by focusing around action levels for those too close to call samples. And we'll collect some additional high and low values to ensure that the relationship that we've developed as part of the DMA continues to hold with respect to our decision error rates, which are ultimately our rates that we're monitoring to ensure that XRF is allowing us to make confident decisions within an expected decision error rate. I'm going to go ahead and skip slide 39, which talks a little bit about how we develop predictive relationships, and jump right to 40. Which is another DMA product. I showed this as part of our DMA relationship, but again, this is our DMA module. But again, this is a very simple series of slides of how we would use a relationship that we've developed as part of the DMA to develop field-based action levels. In this case, we have a scatter plot. We have a lead action level along the x-axis of 400. If we were to estimate what the XRF concentration is along the y-axis, it would be 450. For our XRF value, and as you can see here are the decision rates if we were to use that as a field-based action level. Let's go ahead and jump now to the next slide, 41. If we were uncomfortable with the decision error rate that was in the initial graph there, i.e. that false negative error, we could reduce our field-based action level for XRF to 350, in which case our false negative error would be 0%, but our false positives, situations where XRF says we're above the action level, but a collaborative sample for ICP would say we're below, that actually jumps up to 26%. So if we jump now to the last slide, this is the way that we'd like to get at this issue of maximizing the benefits of both XRF and ICP in a collaborative three-way decision structure.
On slide 42.
Oh, I'm sorry, 42. What did I say, 40?
Yeah, last slide.
Yeah, last slide. Again, you can see the two different XRF field-based action levels along the y-axis there. They correspond to 350 and 450 ppm. Above the 450, both instruments up in the upper right-hand quadrant, both the ICP and the XRF would agree that you have an exceedance of your action level. In the lower left quadrant, both instruments would agree that you have an exceedance, or excuse me, that your samples are clean. And you maintain that 0% false negative error rate, which is the costlier of the two, in the lower right-hand corner. And you also limit the false positive error rate to 7% up in the upper left-hand quadrant. And what you're left with is this range of field-based action levels for XRF, where below 350, you're confident that you're clean. Between 350 and 450, you're going to send those samples off to further develop this relationship, and this is the too-close-to-call range. Send some samples off for collaborative analysis via ICP, and then above 450, we're going to go ahead and say that we have an exceedance and that our sample is dirty. So let's end it there and try to take one or two questions. I think we have two questions in the queue, and we'll finish two or three minutes after this.
Yep, I think we'll take another 2 minutes just to go ahead and address any last-minute questions that are here. No matter what we're able to get through today, you can follow up with the instructors after today's session and email them any remaining questions that you may have or were not addressed, and we will bring them back up on the next module and give a complete answer to the audience then. But in the meantime, if you have a phone question, go ahead, you can take your phone off of mute and speak up. I'm going to read the two that we have submitted online. Again, anything we don't get to right now, we'll come back to starting at our next seminar. The first question submitted online comes in from Tennessee, and they ask, when using the control chart for variable data, do you average 5 out of 10 readings, then chart, or chart each reading individually?
The inputs to development of the chart are based on, hopefully, your DMA, which, as part of your DMA, you want to run your standard reference materials. We recommend 30 or more replicates, basically, of the standard reference materials. That's how you develop what the input is for the mean, the expected mean, and the 2 and 3 standard deviations. And then you chart individual results as your program progresses, and you can watch where those individual results fall within the 2 and 3 standard deviation rule, and then you take corrective action accordingly. So if you take your first result and it's outside of the 2 standard deviations, you would take a second. If your second is outside, you need to take corrective action. If any of your results are outside the 3 standard deviation rule, we would take immediately corrective action. If you take your first sample is outside of the 2 standard deviations, but your second is within, we would say you are within control and you continue on your merry way, conducting your standard reference materials and your continuing calibration checks every 10, 20, 50 samples, whatever you decide as part of your QC program. So the initial piece is actually developed from a series, and each individual result is then charted from there, and it's kind of nice because you can also look for trends and other things in the data. In other words, are they continuing down, are they continuing up, and which way are they trending, and then also if you're outside of control limits, you can take corrective action within a reasonable time frame before you have to go back and redo a whole bunch of results.
The last question online comes in from California. What does an aggregate error result tell you about the sample results? Is this only applicable to readings taken in a, quote, aggregate mode?
Well, I talked to Bob about this as I was making this slide because I knew he was going to talk more about this in his modules. But the results that I used to generate that wasn't done in aggregate mode. It was a series of individual results because what you get in aggregate mode is actually a series of shots, and then the instrument will report to you one average concentration. So the question was, well, how many, if you wanted to do an aggregate, how many shots would contribute to that aggregate, contributing to that aggregate error before you were comfortable with the aggregate result? So the evaluation of that was through a series of 10 shots where I simulated 2 different data sets, and as you can see, the variability of the one data set on the left was sufficient that that 10 shots within a sample support was more than sufficient to get the aggregate error down where we wanted it, whereas the data set on the right still had an aggregate error bordering on 40%, which indicates to you that you've either got to take some additional physical prep of the sample to reduce the variability or do some other things in terms of assessing it. But there comes a point of diminishing returns with regards to multiple readings across a sample, and you know, at a certain point you have to say, you know, 40 readings for a bag is regardless of the count time, is too much, and you have to take, if you want to control that variability, you have to take some physical steps to do that, such as sieving and grinding and some of the other things that Dina talked about.
Okay, well, that is the second and last question I've seen submitted online. We are about 5 minutes past our scheduled end time, so I'm going to complete this portion of our Q&A session. You can continue to submit those questions online. You can also email any of the instructors after today's event. Again, their contact information is on the seminar homepage. You may also email me, Jean Vallant, and we will collect those questions and start off the next series or next seminar series by addressing the leftover questions that we didn't get to today. If you could all be directed to slide number 44, the final slide, you'll see two very important links. The first one to the additional resources, which include a lot of the websites and standards and documents that we've referred to throughout the seminar series. And the second link is the feedback form. It'll take just a moment or two, and we would really appreciate any feedback that you can provide, including how the seminar actually went off, how you were able to participate, what you thought of our instructors, content, and if you'd like to see more series like this in the future. With that, I thank everyone for their time. Hope you have a great afternoon, and then you will join us for part 6 in this 8-part series on XRF here at CLUIN during August, the XRF month. It starts next Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. This Thursday, pardon. Thanks, and have a great day, guys.